Welcome to MIT Talks. I'm Vita Bilkis.
And I'm Dana Attar. MIT Talks set out to bring you the stories that shape the people of MIT.
And I'm Sarah Trace. As the co-hosts of MIT Talks, we go behind the scenes with some of the most influential members of the MIT community, past and present, to dig deeper into their unique and inspiring journeys.
So tune in, listen, learn, and grow.
This is MIT Talks.
There were so many skeptics who didn't believe that you can utilize these techniques to really enable virtual screening, to be able to generate molecules, to understand something new about biology and demonstrate that it can lead to a new discovery about life science.
Today, I'm joined by Professor Regina Barzilay. Regina is a School of Engineering Distinguished Professor for AI and Health. She's also responsible to act as the AI lead for the Jamil Clinic at the Center for AI and Health at MIT. Her research interests are in natural language processing and applications of deep learning to chemistry and oncology. She's a recipient of numerous awards, including the prestigious MacArthur Grant, also known as the Genius Grant. And her most recent award is the Squirrel AI Award from the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, carrying an impressive cash award of $1 million. Professor Barzilay has a unique personal story that has impacted her professional focus. So I'm super excited to have the opportunity to talk with her today and to have this story shared with a larger audience. Thank you so much for joining me on MIT Talks, Regina.
Hey, Sarah. I'm very excited to be here and thank you for taking time to talk to me.
So here at MIT Talks, we focus on the individual journey that led the great people of MIT through its doors. So let's dive right in. So starting back to the early days, can you tell our listeners about where you grew up, a bit about your family and how your early years shaped you such that you later focused on the study of computer science?
So actually, I was born in Moldavia and I was born in a Jewish family. And since my early days, you know, I was told that I have to be the best because as a Jew, my opportunities are quite limited. So it was given. And, you know, my parents always expected me that I will be the top student in the class because, you know, if I want to go to university and study the subject of my interest, which is still was limited by my opportunity being a Jew, I have to really focus on my studies. And what I remember growing up is that I spent a lot of time reading and thinking, and I took it as given the fact that, you know, I have to excel to select a field of study that I want to continue. Then what happened was my family moved to Israel. When I finished high school, my family moved to Israel. And then all of a sudden, you know, things again changed. And instead of being a Jew, I became Russian, even though I come from Moldavia. And during my first year in Israel, I did a variety of jobs, including working in a factory, producing like electronic boards. I collected almonds in kibbutz. I did lots and lots of interesting things until I got to university. And I started studying math, which was very exciting. And eventually I migrated towards computer science. And the reason I migrated was sort of an interesting reason. During actually my math degree, I was having multiple jobs, and one of them was to be a teacher in high school, and I really liked it. But at some point, I became the teacher full-time. And I realized that when you know, at least for me, when, you know, you're kind of not really studying new subjects, you're kind of teaching what you already learn. I mean, there is a lot of interest in how do you teach it and make it clear for students, but it's not like you're not learning new stuff. And at that point, I decided to go back and study computer science. So that's how I end up where I am.
Did you have any major early influencers, maybe other than your family, that really drew you into the sciences, maybe professors or others along the way?
So I think that actually my early influences, I didn't know anybody who did science, and kind of at a time where I grew up, it wasn't expected that I would ever do a career in science, but I read a lot and I read about like really great female scientists like a mathematician, Sofia Kovalevsky and others. And I found these figures very inspiring. And I think books really changed my view on the world and kind of how I envision myself and what I strive to be. And again, when I grew up, you know, we didn't have internet or computers and the information access was pretty controlled where I grew up. But the books really showed me all the great things one can do. And those are my really early influences.
So you have three major areas of research: natural language processing, oncology, and chemistry. And I'm very familiar with your chemistry work, actually. But for those of us who are new to the area of natural language processing, can you describe a bit about what that is?
So natural language processing, it's an area of AI that aims to design algorithms that can process language and perform useful tasks like machine translation that most of us are using, you know, information retrieval when you want to find relevant documents on Google, text summarization, and many others. And, you know, when I started working in this area, which was like in 95, 96, I took a class, natural language processing class, and the field was so young that there was actually no system that we've seen that were doing something. We were theoretically discussing how to build a system. And I remember when I went to my first conference in 97, you know, people were talking about building machine translation system in the same way as somebody talks about, you know, building a house on the moon, you know, something that, you know, may happen in the future, but maybe not in our lifetime. And it was really remarkable to see what a humongous progress this field made, that today everybody, you know, including my own son, uses machine translation and all this great natural language processing that really changes the way we interact with both written and spoken information.
It's really interesting. And now I want to focus on your work in oncology, because this is remarkable what you've been able to do there. And here you have a really incredible personal story that has really guided your research in that area. Would you mind telling that story and how that has directly translated into what you do today?
So I was happily doing natural language processing until, and still, I'm still doing it. But, you know, the break point for me was actually 2014 when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And before that, I was never really sick with anything. And this was the first time that I actually had to experience, you know, American clinical system on myself. And I realized during my treatment, you know, how primitive is a system in terms of how information is used. You know, like even a simple decision making is based on clinical trials that happen on a different population that maybe happened like a decade ago. And each one of us, when we go to the doctor and we are prescribed treatment, there are outcomes. And all this information is currently lost and not utilized by the system. After going through this treatment, I decided that part of my kind of missions in life is to change it. And of course, you know, I was overambitious, but I really try very hard to make sure that we can find at least some ways to bring all these amazing technologies that we're developing at MIT in the AI space to benefit patients and to reduce their suffering. And unfortunately, you know, I saw so much suffering, not my own, I saw many other people, you know, during treatment. And I thought we cannot just continue doing what we're doing and stamp our papers, but it's really important to benefit those who really need help of the technology the most. And since then, I focused on kind of two big areas within the oncology. One, which is more immediate effect, is actually risk assessment and diagnostics. I didn't have anybody in my family who had breast cancer, so it came as a surprise to me. So in some ways, it's not a very surprising disease because, you know, depending on the country, 1 in 7 or 1 in 8 women get breast cancer. But, you know, I didn't have any indication that I was at risk. And we now have models that can look at the mammogram and predict the patient's likelihood to develop breast cancer within up to 5 years with very high accuracy. We tested these models in many different populations. They deliver quite well. And now we expanded it to other diseases like lung cancer, which is, again, a surprise. A very small portion of the population gets it, but it's very lethal. And if you can predict and screen separately and maybe treat people who are likely to be high risk, you can really make disease, which is currently hard to treat, to make it much more treatable and manageable. So this is one area. And then another area that I work is drug discovery. I work with a number of people at MIT on building models that can predict what are the properties of different molecules and how to generate molecules with a desired pharmaceutical profile.
This is an incredible story. And I'm just wondering, how widely utilized is your research, you know, throughout maybe, you know, Massachusetts, or really is this being used?
Most of my work was focused on Massachusetts General Hospital. Actually, now the system that reads mammograms is used. For instance, during the COVID pandemics, the system was used to identify which women need to be screened, because as you remember, in Boston, screening facilities and many other non-essential services were stopped, and the screening facility was reduced due to the COVID regulation. So these models were used to identify those patients who cannot be, you know, delayed and needs to be screened. So right now, like last year, we actually wanted to make sure, before broadly applying this technology, we wanted to make sure that it really works across different populations. We know that there are existing models that identify risk, which actually are not working well on African Americans, on Latina population, and so on. We wanted to make sure that our technology does work. So we tested it in lots and lots of places, in like Emory University, which have a big portion of African American patients. We tested in Latin America, in Brazil. We tested it in Asian population in Taipei. So we did a lot of testing. We saw that the model is doing well. And currently we are ready to move to the next step, which is developing, you know, clinical trials, where you want not only to say, you know, this patient has high risk, but really to say what is a pathway for this patient which would improve their healthcare outcomes. So we are in collaboration with lots and lots of different hospitals who are testing and finding a way how to implement this technology in clinical care.
Excellent. I mean, you would hope that this would become so widespread that, you know, every woman is getting this kind of screening young, right? That would be an incredible thing to have done. And so I was reading a bit about your work, and you have very unique algorithms that require less data, because this is really a big data situation, right? We have to have a lot of it. So where are you getting your data, and like, what makes your algorithm so unique to be able to do this so well?
So it depends, you know, in which area are we talking about? So if you are talking about like data related to imaging, this is actually one of the biggest and hardest questions on how to find the right data. It's kind of ridiculous that today in the United States, we don't have a publicly available corpus of mammograms that people can just, who develop machine learning methods, can just take it and try to improve the methods, because of, you know, various concerns related, of course, to patient privacy, but also because the owners of the data may not be interested to share this data. So toward this goal, actually, we just recently developed a new algorithm that enables to learn in privacy preserving fashion, so that you can take the data, like if you're a hospital, you can take an image, you can encode it, and then train your machine learning model to make predictions on this encoded image. So it would hopefully enable to put out, you know, in a public domain, the patient data in a privacy preserving way. And it would be, more importantly, enable hospitals to combine their data to improve machine learning predictions, which is really important, because for even for common diseases, you may not have enough patients with certain profiles, and these patients are going to be, you know, their accuracy on them will be sacrificed in the general algorithm. So with a big team of faculty at MIT that come from, you know, information theory, security, machine learning, we created this algorithm that is going to hopefully help us. Now, on the case of chemistry and AI, it's very interesting, you know, how we're thinking about the data. When we just started working in this field, we were in some ways a bit naive, saying, you know, I have a molecule and I have a structure. And if you're a computer scientist, you just see it as a graph. You're going to say, I'm going to learn the properties of the molecule, let's say antibacterial properties, looking at this graph. And, you know, you can deliver the goods. If you have a lot of screening data, it works. You can really focus on how to translate this graph into a proper kind of embedding in a high dimensional space and make the predictions. But especially during COVID, we see the situations where we didn't have enough of the screening data. For instance, we were asked by NCATS, which is one of the institutes of NIH, to predict combinations of antivirals for COVID. And we just have less than 200 combinations, which is very small. And what we've done jointly with Tommy Yakala, who is my collaborator in this space, really focus on students, how to incorporate biological information to improve the model robustness. And for instance, in this case, by incorporating the biological mechanism, the targets, we were able to deliver some interesting, you know, antiviral combinations. So, you know, different pathways, but I think the data problem is really so pervasive. So there is not one recipe, but again, depending where you are, we're looking at different types of algorithmic solutions.
That's great. And I'm curious with your both oncology and chemistry research, given that you've had some time in these spaces now, have you seen where your research has actually had a direct impact?
So I would say that in both areas, it already had direct impact. Jointly with a number of MIT faculty like Klaus Jensen, Bill Green, Tommy Yakala, and Connor Cooley, we are co-leading machine learning for Pharmaceutical Discovery and Synthesis Consortium, where we developed a lot of tools that are currently utilized in big and small pharmaceutical company in discovery. These tools enable to predict molecular properties, to generate new molecules, to identify, you know, the best pathway to synthesize the molecules. So it was very gratifying to see that these tools are broadly used and see how they are changing the discovery. But in addition, locally at MIT, in collaboration with Jim Collins, Jonathan Stokes, and Tommy Yakala, we were actually able to demonstrate locally what kind of discoveries you can make. And we, you know, using these methods, came up with a number of very strong antibacterial molecules. One of them was halicin, which maybe got more recognition than others, where we, using this kind of in silico screening methods, we were able to identify a small subset of molecules that were later tested in the lab and tested in an animal that show very strong antibacterial properties against pathogens for which, you know, kind of standard cures fail. So this is, you know, another example. And finally, I think that the tools that we develop for mammography and for lung cancer, they are, especially for mammography, they're already beginning to be incorporated in the clinical care. For instance, some tools for reading mammograms like density assessment is clinically used at MGH since 2018. So it's really nice to see that people utilize it, and hopefully it improves, you know, patient outcomes.
No, it's really excellent. And, you know, this is relatively small field of study. Is that correct? Or how many other people around the world are working on this area?
So talking about imaging, actually, there are a lot of companies that work in this area. There are some, you know, universities that are working in this area. This is the challenge there. If you are within the academia, is really you really need to have a very strong clinical collaborators that would be able to share the data with you and would be able to utilize your discovery. But I'm really glad to report that at MIT, the number of faculty who work, you know, on clinical AI is really increasing, and we are making the difference. Relatively to, you know, AI for drug discovery and chemistry modeling, MIT was kind of was the leading force in this field. And when we started working on it in 2015 or 16, there was very little core machine learning research in this area. But I'm happy to report that, you know, every year this field becomes bigger and bigger. And big part of it is not only, you know, that it makes impact, but actually what our research demonstrated, there are a lot of interesting technical problems that needs to be solved. So many students and researchers are attracted to contribute to this area. And this is great because there are so many new discoveries to be made with AI in these areas.
Yeah, I can attest to that as a former medicinal chemist myself. I do know how powerful the chemistry tools are. And to your point, it is a rapidly growing field, which I think, even though it's become a very competitive space, you know, both from research and a business perspective, the more people that are in the area, the better it is for everyone out there. So really, really great stuff. So we just started chatting a little bit about MIT and the awesome faculty there that you have a chance to work with. So how long have you been at MIT now?
I've been at MIT since 2003.
Did you always start in the same department, or kind of what was your journey into MIT over those years?
So I was always in electrical engineering and computer science department. So this is my home department, and I'm very happy to be there, and I'm still there. But I was very lucky to be able to collaborate with people across many other departments at MIT. And a lot of the research that I've produced is really direct result of this connection and collaboration.
Okay. And so who would you say are some of the most important people that you've interacted with at MIT or collaborated with?
There were two people who, kind of were with me since the very beginning, since 2003, and really had a big role in shaping me, you know, as a scientist. Is two professors. One is Professor Dina Katabi. We started jointly in 2003. And another one is Professor Martin Reiner. They're really outstanding scientists. And the reason I'm so inspired by them is because they really think in a non-traditional way. Even if you're a scientist at MIT, there is always some pressure to conform. The closer your paper to the average kind of conference paper, typically it means that it's more likely that the paper is going to be accepted because people can understand it better. And kind of the more outrageous is your idea, the harder it is to push it. And these two faculty, and they're my close friends, really never conform. They think in a different way. They are very brave about it, and they just put out these new ideas. And it's great to see, you know, how their thinking is changing over the years, and they kind of never stay in the same place and do more of the same. So this is very inspiring. Another two people that, you know, impacted me when I was moving to this new space, when I started moving towards oncology and biology, was Professor Phil Sharp and Professor Susan Hochfeld, who was our president emerita. I mean, they were both in Koch Institute. And I remember, you know, when I strolled into their offices in an naive way to say, you know, everything that people are doing in cancer research is wrong. It doesn't help patients. And I want to do it in a different way. So I was pretty naive and kind of outrageous in my claims. But they really helped me to orient myself in this space and connected me and to focus, you know, what are the important problems. And until today, I really greatly benefit from their advice and from their involvement with Jameel Clinic, where a lot of this research happens. So really, really grateful. And the final person that I want to mention here is, of course, you know, my students, each one of them had, I'm talking about my research group, you know, my students and postdocs, really each one of them had a big impact on my life and on my thinking. And I was debating with myself if I should just pick up one, and I thought I have to. So this is a student of mine called Adam Yala. And the reason I want to pick him up from this set of these amazing, excellent students is because he really was the instrumental for me getting into clinical AI. And I should say, when I started in this field, I didn't have, you know, good understanding of, you know, where to go. I didn't have any funding. We didn't have data. And we had so many challenges in the beginning. It was really failure after failure after failure. It took a long time to take it off the ground. And Adam Yala is not only a brilliant, student, but another thing that he really had this determination and maturity to believe in this idea that AI can help patients and stick to it and really make these big contributions. And it goes from the small things like, you know, creating the data to developing very interesting algorithms and also helping to implement them in the hospitals. So without Adam's direct involvement and you know, leadership in this area, I don't think I could have ever done what, you know, I was able to do jointly with him and other students in oncology. So I'm really grateful for the people that I mentioned and many, many others that I didn't mention, you know, who really shaped my thinking and my personality while I was at MIT.
Sounds like you have an amazing group of scientists around you to really support your research, which is, I think, one of the best parts of MIT is just the brain power you're surrounded with and the personalities there. So that's really great. And if you were to pick one highlight of your career so far, what would it be?
Maybe the most surprising and exciting piece was work on AI and chemistry. Because when we started, you know, I always kind of see how much surprise do you get out of certain results. So if you work in machine translation today and you improve your system and now it's more fluent, of course, you know, there is a delta here. But when we start working on chemistry, there was very little. And there were so many skeptics who didn't believe that you can utilize these techniques to really enable virtual screening, to be able to generate molecules with the right properties, to understand something new about biology. It was really not there. And I think the fact that jointly with other people at MIT, which is again Tommy Yakala, the students, Wengong Jin, Klaus Jensen, Kona Kuli, and others, we sort of were able to create the foundation and demonstrate that it can be used and it can lead to a new discovery about life sciences. So I think this is, again, because it's the most surprising and unexpected result. That's why I would, you know, highlight it.
Mm-hmm. And we know that life is full of challenges and obstacles. And I think it's easy for us to look at others and especially someone who's so accomplished and to forget that everyone has a hill to climb. And can you share with our listeners what one of the most challenging moments professionally was for you and how you overcame it?
Yeah, so this is, thank you, Sarah, for bringing it up. Because, you know, when we look at somebody's polished CV, it sounds, you know, like this person have this amazing career. And I sort of alluded to it earlier that when I, you know, I came back after my cancer treatment in 2015 to MIT, you know, I came back and my whole thinking totally changed. I realized I need to do something else, but I didn't know what I need to do and how to do it. And then when I kind of committed that I'm going to work on imaging for oncology and other areas, especially in clinical AI, it was failure after failure after failure. I submitted 3 grants. All of them were rejected. I tried to get funding. I couldn't get any funding. I would constantly meet with people and nothing will come out of this meeting. I would be unable to get the data. And, you know, at some point, you really, you know, asking yourself, is it even feasible? And it's not like I've seen many positive examples when people succeeded in this area. And there were moments that I was like, I don't know where I am going, you know? And I felt that I'm fighting with the whole world because I was surprised how come people didn't see that it's a must and you have to do it. But eventually, you know, every day I sort of had, you know, my list of items that I need to do. And somehow I went through this list of items. And eventually things start moving. And again, and having like the right support, people who believed in me and people who were there to work with me was really crucial. Identifying the right people who can help was instrumental, like Adam, one of them, again, Phil, Sharp, Susan, and others. But at the end, when I'm thinking what was like the key part, I felt I don't have a choice. You know, I felt I get out of this treatment alive and I felt I have to do it. It's like there is no option. I have to do it. And, you know, failure in this area was not an option. And somehow it worked out. And I cannot say that everything is rosy and everything is solved. You know, there is still, you know, a lot of unresolved issues. And each time, you know, when we are moving to a new stage of our deployment, there are questions like last year we had a question, how do you deploy it across many parts of the world and test it? So it was challenging. Now we are discussing how to do clinical trials. It's challenging, but I just stick, you know, to the bigger goal, and that's what helped to, you know, to persist.
Yeah, it sounds like the persistence is really what came out of there. And it's just so hard to believe that in such an important area of research that you struggled to get the attention and you know, the funding that you would need is, and I'm sure now that's not really an issue. You're like world renowned in this space. So I'm sure that that has improved significantly. And so what is next for you? And where do you see yourself and your research in maybe 5 or 10 years?
And so it's always hard to speculate what's going to happen in 5 to 10 years. But one thing which is kind of obvious to me, despite all the progress, you know, in AI for chemistry and AI, you know, for oncology, we still cannot really say that, you know, that is like a drug that is treating people. There is a disease, you know, ALS or whatever, any disease that, you know, we designed fully the drug with AI and it cured people. And there are technical challenges which prevent us from solving many of these questions. So I hope that, you know, within the next 5-10 years, we would be able to make further advancements that would enable us to see these new cures, which are really powered by AI. And in terms of, you know, clinical AI, I really hope that all this great technology that is developed in the labs will be part of patient care, and not only like in kind of high-end research clinical institutions, but really around the world. And I don't yet know what are the technological pieces that we need to add. I have some ideas, but I believe that as we are moving this technology closer to the patient, there will be a lot of new algorithms that one would have to develop, and that's where I see myself working.
And you probably don't get to leave your department that often, but I'm curious, if you were able to take one course at MIT, what would it be and why?
Oh, there are lots of things that I really want to do. And I always feel so embarrassed that, you know, my knowledge in chemistry and biology is really patchy. So I have the whole list of courses that I'm going to be taking this summer.
Nice.
In these areas. And I have it open on my computer, the course that I'm going to be taking. And it's not at MIT, but it's, you know, it's available online in Fundamentals of Humanology. So this is the courses that I really hope to advance my understanding.
That's great. Well, you certainly fake it well in terms of your chemistry knowledge. I've seen you speak on the topic and it's pretty awesome. So I'm going to just pivot to you now. And incredibly successful people typically have a formula for success. So do you have any daily habits that serve your well-being, and how did that become a habit for you?
So one thing that, you know, I do, I wake up at 4 a.m. every day.
Wow.
And I go to sleep early, but I wake up at 4 and I try to do, I go for a daily run early in the morning. And I also try to do most of my kind of intellectual work before everybody wake up. So, you know, I get maybe 2 to 3 hours of productive work in the morning. And this is the time that I try to protect from everything and everybody. And, you know, obviously I continue working during the day, but when I really need to think or to write, this is the time when I do it. So this is my daily habit. And then there is another piece that I learned. It's actually from one of the winners, a female winner from Boston Marathon. So they kind of ask her, how did she manage to do it? Unfortunately, I don't remember her name. And one thing that she said was, every day you put your shoes and you run. And, you know, sometimes it's going to be great run. Sometimes it's not going to be great run. So I try that, even if I feel that I don't have great ideas or the things are not where I want them to be, you know, I try not to use it as an excuse and just, you know, focus on what needs to be done.
Every day you put your shoes on. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're all very busy these days. In fact, we're on a call on a Sunday morning just to squeeze this in, because I know you're so busy. And I got an email from you at 5:30 this morning, so I will attest to your early mornings. But do you have any non-negotiables, maybe other than not skipping the run, things that you do to protect your time?
I have a 14-and-a-half-year-old son. And I really try hard to make sure that we are spending quality time together. So in the evenings, I spend time with him. And during this pandemic, it actually opened my eyes, because there were months and months when he didn't have school, or he had just, you know, 1.5 days at school and he was at home. And I made sure I rearranged my schedule that I can be with him. And I pretty much did for part of the year homeschooling, and I arrange my day around it, that I can you know, not only sit with him in the same room, but really be engaged with him. And this pandemic year was maybe the highest number of hours I really quality spent with him, which was one of the unexpected advantages. But I decided now, given how I see how it changes our interaction, that, you know, moving forward when, you know, his school is going to be working and MIT is going to be open, I will make sure that this tradition continues.
That's great. And so now we're going to, I just want to thank you for this. This has been incredible. And I got goosebumps several times throughout your story. So I really appreciate you opening up and sharing with the MIT community your amazing story. And we're going to wrap up with our signature questions here on MIT Talks. And so what is one book, and I know you're an avid reader actually, that you think everyone should read?
I would say a book that had a big impact on me, with which I really connect, is Americana. And it was a book of the year, I think maybe 2 years ago at MIT. So I think whether you are an immigrant and you're joining this culture, or you are, you know, talking to many immigrants, it really has a lot of experiences that I felt were related to my life. And it made me think differently about, you know, many things that when I was moving countries and joining different cultures, I never actually thought about it. And this book helped me to think through it and maybe connect differently to people, you know, around me.
Americana, fabulous. I'll have to pick that one up. Our next one is, if you could use one word to describe your past, one word to describe your present, and one for your future, what would they be?
So for the past, I would say robust. For the current time, I would say grateful. And for the future, I would say curious.
What are you most curious about in the future?
You know, what I will be doing, you know, how I you asked me earlier the question, you know, what I'm going to be doing in 5 or 10 years. So if you would ask me this question, you know, even 5 years ago, I would never imagine that I will be doing research that I'm doing. So it's like, just there are lots of different possibilities and options. I see that, you know, even my reading taste changes all the time. So I have no clue, you know, what I will be doing in 5 or 10 years. So I'm curious to see, you know, these opportunities. And maybe, you know, I'm really curious if I would be able to pass my driving test, because I still cannot drive. So I'm curious.
Well, good luck with that. Pretty soon your son will be able to help you, right?
Learners. I know. This is a deadline.
And our last question is, would you rather have a library full of books or a contact list full of names?
Clearly a library full of books. I still find it's much easier to learn about the world from books than to learn it from people.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for your time. This has really been a treat for me. I've been watching your work for many years. And so just having the opportunity to learn more about you has really been a real treat for me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for another inspiring episode of MIT Talks.
We would love to hear from you, our listeners. Engage with us at MIT Club of Boston's website or any of our social media channels.
Please send us your ideas for future podcast guests or reach out to further the conversation with your awesome co-hosts.
Thank you for listening to the MIT Talks.